V1. Pull up. Pull up. Pull up. Terrain, terrain. Pull up, terrain.
Welcome to the Flight Safety Detectives. Hosts John Golia and Greg Fife, two of the world's most respected aviation safety experts, talk all things related to aviation and aerospace. This podcast and the Flight Safety Detectives YouTube channel are brought to you by the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, PAMA, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance and your one stop for all general aviation insurance needs. Get a customized quote at Avemco.com or give them a call at 888-879-0389. Tell them you're a listener of the show and receive a 5% discount. Now it's time to buckle up because it's wheels up for the latest episode of Flight Safety Detectives.
Well, hello, Todd. Here we are in another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. You and I, and Greg is off. I believe he's in Colorado, but he's off buried down doing something. So it'll be you and I. And I want to remind everybody that this show is sponsored by Avemco. And in keeping with what we've been saying since our episode with the young lady that had a rental airplane and she damaged it, and we're going to talk about a rental airplane damage today, I want to remind everybody that Avemco can provide you with renter's insurance to protect you beyond where whatever the airline or the operator, owner of the airplane has. And Todd, you can speak to that because you've done it.
Yeah, I can indeed. And again, this is a revisiting something I've talked about a couple times before. That is, there's an aircraft that I rent on a regular basis that had been involved in an incident a few months ago that damaged the wing. Aircraft was fully repaired. It's fully flyable. And I have no hesitation flying that aircraft. But I did have an interest in just finding out what were the circumstances. If for no other reason than the incident happened at the airport I fly into most often. So if there's something about that airport that I should know about that might be a hazard in the future, I want to know. If there was something about the conditions, the weather conditions that are frequently happening there that contributed to this, I wanted to know. And being a very data-driven person, I thought, well, let me see if there's something in the official records of the FAA or the NTSB. Just to recap, I had heard from my flying organization that the aircraft I had been in was in an incident. And I asked around about this aircraft because during an inspection before flight, I noticed that parts of the aircraft seemed new. And I thought, well, what's going on here? And I thought, okay, this was in a wingtip incident. No big deal because this airplane still flies great. I have no qualms about flying it. I just had a general interest in what happened. So the first thing I did was I did a very easy thing. I typed the tail number of the aircraft into a search engine and saw what popped up. And what came up at first was something to do with Catherine's report. I clicked on it and it had some very, very basic information about where it occurred, the time and place. I thought, okay, this is consistent with what I'd heard. Where do I go to next? And in, you know, someone who looks at this from an outside perspective, I have my own way of looking for information. But insiders like yourself who have been part of this process for decades, there's probably other things going on that the average person should know about as far as who has what information and where.
You know, the NTSB is resource constrained. If you talk to them, that's what they'll tell you. But they leave a lot of these incidents off to the FAA to do, and a lot of accidents. Most people don't realize that the vast majority of actual accidents are investigated by the FAA, not the NTSB. And they're a different animal when the FAA does them. Pretty close to factual. Who, what, when, where, and the why sometimes is not answered very well. And they don't also dig the way the NTSB is capable of. And that is, you know, the last 72 hours, what the pilot was doing. You know, they don't always go for the toxicology testing. You know, so there's a lot of other things that the NTSB does routinely, oftentimes, that the FAA inspectors do not perform. So there's different levels of these inspections. So if you see it, if something happens and a dragging a wingtip and damage it substantially that it's gotta be replaced, it's certainly an accident, but you won't necessarily find it on the NTSB website or their database because they didn't record it. And
that was my experience. I looked at the NTSB database for this tail number in this location. There was nothing there, not a preliminary report, not a final report. So that's exactly my experience.
Right. So, and that leads to some of the differences that we see in the number of accidents and the categories that they occur in. Oftentimes, when you compare the NTSB's data with the FAA's data, with Captain's Report data, and there's a number of other organizations that are out there that collect accident information more narrowly than the broad spectrum. You know, NBAA does it. The couple of the magazines do their own tracking for accidents that sometimes use government data, sometimes use independently ferreted out information. So if you really go dig down into an accident investigation, you've got to search far and wide through a number of sources, and because you don't find it in one, don't think it doesn't exist. So, you know, you and I are very well experienced with that, chasing down these animals, because we get tons of emails every week recommending that we look at this accident or that accident. And then you go into the NTSB's database, you can't find it. And you go to the FAA, you can't find it. And then you start going down the trail trying to find out where it is, because you got some detail, you got somebody that verified that it happened, and now you've got to try to find the little nugget wherever it is. But I've been concerned about this for 30 plus years. This type of issue is, how much data are we losing? You know, we have a data-driven system for safety in this country and mostly around the world. And if you have insufficient data, poor quality data, data with big holes in it for facts, what's coming out the other end? It's not the most accurate data you want. And what do we do with the data that comes out on the other end? The FAA and other people, businesses, spend a lot of money generating training programs based upon that data that comes out the other end. And if it's not accurate, are we wasting money? Are we spending money in areas that we don't need to spend them, where they could have more bang for the buck if we put it in a different area? Because the data isn't as finite as it needs to be, we're missing those opportunities.
So this is something that, you know, you and I have been dealing with for decades. In fact, when I wrote my first book, which was called Understanding Aviation Safety Data, it was basically a book about what's the process I use and my colleagues use to chase down information about accidents. So I thought, okay, I wrote about this, let me do my own process. And one of the resources I talk about then that still exists now is the FAA's information about incidents. And they have a very nice database that is very limited in what they put out there. But one of the limitations is, if it's over 10 business days, you might not find it. So in the event I'm talking about, I found out about it well over 10 days after the event, and I went to the website, there was nothing there. And I thought, okay, in most cases, this is about where I'd end my search, because if I'm just casually looking at some event of this level of damage and no injuries, my level of interest isn't high. But I had a vested interest. This is an aircraft I had flown in. This is an aircraft I would continue to fly in. And by the way, I flew in the aircraft before it had the incident. I flew in the aircraft after it was repaired. One of the reasons why I have full faith in what was done to it was that I noticed no difference in flying characteristics. But be that as it may, I thought, I tried to go broad. I went Catherine's report, I went NTSB, I went FAA. Now it's time to go deep. And this brings up an issue, again, you alluded to, accessibility versus availability. A lot of the basic information is accessible, Catherine's report, et cetera, et cetera. excuse me, a lot of it is available. That is, there's data out there, but it's accessible in limited ways. Catherine's report, very limited. The FAA incident database, very limited. NTSB decided not to put on it. It is available. How do you get to it? That's where the Freedom of Information Act came in for me. I did a request. I got a set of data, including a very good narrative description of what happened. And I thought that was the end of it. A few days ago, I got another email from the FAA saying, oh, by the way, we found some more things for you. You mentioned photographs. We found photographs. So now, and you'll see this in the video version of the show, there are a number of photographs of the damage that was on the aircraft. And I thought that was very instructive for me because I had my own mental picture of what a bent wingtip would look like. Then I had the actual data that was out there. And John, you reviewed some of these pictures. And what's your impression looking at the level of damage that you saw on this aircraft?
That's substantial. I mean, we're looking at 4 or 5 feet of the wing, at least from the picture, that's severely wrinkled. So it had a pretty good strike. I mean, I've worked on a number of airplanes that are ground looped that had less damage than that airplane. So he took a pretty good hit on that wing. So he had to have himself pretty messed up at that point in landing. But, you know, as you're going to go on and say, he just accomplished a number of landings successfully. So what's different? What was the difference in this landing than the previous ones that he was so successful at? Having that information could be helpful. Could be helpful to the community in general, but it also could be helpful to the airport. You know, with the runway and what's around it, and maybe there's some reasons. You know, one of the things, as you were talking about this earlier, one of the things that I think of often when we talk about the environments around airports today, with so many buildings on the perimeters of airports. In Boston here, we have a rather big complex in Copley Square called Prudential Center. And when they built that complex, there was a spot in the open area, like a courtyard between these big buildings, where people could walk and congregate. We've actually had people injured being picked up by the winds that were being redirected and changed because of the high-rise buildings. And they've since closed it in to prevent those kinds of injuries and issues, but something that was not foreseen when they built the buildings, that the impact it would have on existing environmental conditions, meaning the wind. So, you know, there's an airport in New Jersey that I just had a conversation with somebody yesterday about the buildings going up along the edge. And the developers were telling the potential occupants of the buildings that don't worry about the airport, it's going to be gone. We're going to develop that airport and that airport's going to be gone. Well, it hasn't gone. It's been there for quite a while and it's probably going to be there for a while longer because of federal grants and federal money in it. The local community is not going to be able to get rid of it. But the land has become very valuable. And those high-rise buildings, for all we know, could be having an effect on the wind direction, and the velocity. Nobody's checking it. Nobody's doing anything about it. So accidents like this could have some impact if somebody in the safety organization of the aviation world were to take a look at that.
And that speaks to something I read separately some time ago, basically, and this is something I got clued into when we went to AirVenture in 2021, that a lot of smaller general aviation airports around the country is a real attractant for places like Amazon, which are building warehouses and distribution centers at those airports. Now, depending on the airport, you could have a shift in wind patterns or a shift in turbulence going across the runway, depending on where the building is put up. And without going into detail, there are very specific regulations as to where you can build things if it might impact the flight path as you're taking off and landing. I have seen very few, if any, federal regulations with respect to how building structures could affect wind patterns or local turbulence, et cetera, on runways. And getting back to the incident with the wing strike, what you said about how this pilot was performing, the narrative was very, very instructive. It said basically there were, I believe, 7 takeoff and landing attempts in the loop, which were successful. And the last one was where they had the problem. This was an instructional flight. And the narrative specifically said that the instructor took over the aircraft after it bounced the first time. So basically, and you can see it on the picture that we have on the video version of this, it was a fairly stable number of patterns that were flown with apparently the student pilot at the controls. So I saw nothing there that stood out as, oh, this was like unstable patterns, whatever. No, it looked like things were going quite well. And the instructor took over right at the end and basically was on the controls when the wingtip struck. So the narrative very much focused on the instructor, the instructor's decisions, the actions taken, and left the student pilot out of it, which I thought was an interesting way of going about it. But I think it's an appropriate thing. It's like, this was a person who was in control of the aircraft at the time the wing strike hit. And so I think it was appropriate personally that they focus on that person. Now, what you said about the learning potential of this, sure, I heard about this event in my organization, but I didn't have anything like the level of detail and certainly no photographs of it. So the Freedom of Information Act information had a lot of information that was very useful. Some information that was inappropriate for a learning environment. For example, this report actually had the name, birth date, certificate number of the pilot, which was irrelevant with respect to how are we going to learn from this, because it was not a personal thing. It was not something where the pilot was pointed out, oh, this pilot was incompetent. It was a set of circumstances, and there was no FAA sanction, no pulling of a certificate, no fines, nothing like that. It was one of these things. It was an accident and something that we can learn from. And now that I have the narrative, now that I have the photographs, it gives me a fuller picture. And, you know, I'm crossing my fingers. Maybe there's more stuff the FAA has that they'll eventually dig out and give me from a Freedom of Information Act request. One more part to the story. I thought, well, gee, I didn't see anything in the NTSB website about this, but what if they have information but didn't publish it? So I put in a Freedom of Information Act request to the NTSB about this very same incident. So we'll see what happens.
It'll be interesting to see if they haven't, and they just haven't indexed it in there. Yeah, it's just, you know, information is power. You know, it's the power to fix problems. It's the problem, the power to change flight training for pilots. It's very, very meaningful in the system we have for transportation safety in the United States.
And one of the things I mentioned earlier is that this is the long game we're playing. That is, this event happened. It took a very short time for this event to happen. It took a few days or weeks to repair the airplane. The airplane's going to fly for years. But the lessons that can be learned could be valuable decades from now. So let's say there's an event, or more than one event, that you have a deep interest in. Do what you think is necessary to come to grips with that, to understand it, whether it's Freedom of Information Act requests, whether it's interviewing people, whether it's researching the internet. There is nothing that says you have to stop looking at events. There's nothing that says that you can't learn something from events. And there's definitely nothing that says you have to be a pilot or a mechanic or someone in the business to do this. If you have an interest and you have an inquisitive mind, go for it.
Yes. And actually, if we get young people involved in doing the research into the data, they'll become hooked on aviation, which is something we're having a big problem doing today, is getting enough people hooked on aviation to give us the manpower to grow, because the demand is there.
And the hooking on aviation, you don't have to be an aviation professional or a pilot, a mechanic, or something, an air traffic controller. Let's say your thing is you like to put together TikTok videos. I don't put together TikTok videos. I barely watch TikTok videos, but I hear it's a very popular thing. Let's say you have your own spin on it, whether it's serious or not so serious. You know what? Every point of view is useful. Now, if you do something that's inappropriate and not helpful to anybody, that's one thing. But then again, being a troll, doesn't matter what the subject is. If you have an intent to ridicule people, make fun of people, or to denigrate people or organizations, that's not going to be helpful to aviation. But if you have any other point of view, I don't care what it is, I might check it out.
You know what? You just tickled my memory a little bit. Back in my USA days, I remember that we had 6,000 odd pilots, 6,500 pilots. We had about the same number of mechanics. And we had a little bit more like 8,000 flight attendants. So that's 20,000 people roughly. But we had almost 100,000 employees at US Air at that time. So that meant there's, these numbers are very fudgy, but roughly 80,000 other jobs in aviation that don't require certification from the FAA. We had IT people, planners, provisioning people, we call them stores on most airlines, buyers for equipment. You know how much goods and services the airlines buy every year? A huge number. Just think about, it used to be the food, but think about all the other things that they buy that are used and consumed on every single flight. So there are tons and tons of jobs in the thousands for people that have an interest in aviation, but don't have the professional standards, the skills, the pilot rating, flight mechanic, and so on, that they could fill. And, so if you love aviation, but you're not a pilot, you don't want to be a pilot, you don't want to be a mechanic, there's a ton of other jobs to do. My own daughter works at the airport and started it. She started working for me in my own company. And then she went to an FBO, then she went to an airline. And now she's a manager, station manager, multiple stations manager. So there's all kinds of opportunity in aviation for both FAA certified people and non-certified people.
And if you're a member, if you have someone, close member of your family who's involved in aviation, in an unpaid, voluntary way, just like with any other family business, if you can help out your sister, your uncle, whatnot, understand some aspect of it, you happen to have a knack for it, then do it. Especially if you have someone older in your family who's good at the internet, but you're someone who's younger than me in the family who's great at the internet, help them out. Help them find information. Help them put things out if they want to do a Freedom of Information Act request or do a YouTube video or just do a personal reminiscence video about some aspect of what they did that they want to share with the world. There could be folks out there who have stories that are worth hearing. You don't have to go on a television network or cable show or whatever to have it heard. You can take your phone, do a video, put it on YouTube, even if the only people you're sharing with is other members of the family. It helps them understand, why is it that Uncle Joe wanted to go into this business as opposed to what we went into? Or why is this person spending huge amounts of money trying to be an airline pilot? Well, hey, let them tell their story on film and put it out there.
Todd, we still get a number of emails from people that want to know how you're doing with your training, your return to flight. So what's the latest update? You flew yesterday?
I flew a couple days ago, and I laid off for about a month for a bunch of reasons because of scheduling and I was on travel. So rather than going into things specific for instrument flying, it was basically basic stick and rudder skills, which I was practicing, which fortunately, because I've been doing self-study, including doing simulation on X-plane, which is good for procedures training, it's not good for getting the physical feel of the airplane, I felt more comfortable returning after about a month off than I did before. And I also did some work to make sure that I had a more consistent schedule week after week, at least a couple of times where I'm either in an aircraft or in a simulator. And by simulator, I mean not my X-plane I have at home, but an actual simulator that can be counted toward my hours necessary to get an instrument rating. And the way the rules work, you can do up to 20 hours of your instruction prior to your instrument certificate in a certified trainer. So I talked with my instructor. I told him about where I want to do this. He understands that organization. He knows the instructors who are there. For logistical reasons, he can't be the instructor in the trainer, but he trusts the trainers, the CFIs who are available to do that. So again, there is a stick and rudder skills. There is the management skills. There's the, how do we make sure that I'm doing this in a way that adheres to the regulations and allows me to maintain a certain level of competency? This 1 month or so off was something I didn't plan for, but circumstances got in the way. I redoubled my effort to make sure that I'm either in an actual airplane or in a simulator that counts towards my certificate hours. And I want to consistently do this until I get to the point where I take my test and get my certification.
Hey, good update. Well, I think we've talked this subject to death for now. I'm sure we'll be back on, maybe not this subject, but one's right close to it, because it seems like we repeat our accidents over and over and over. We don't seem to be leaving them behind us very well. Well, since we don't have Greg here to do the close part of the closing, why don't you start the closing and I'll give my standard closing.
Well, very few words I like to give. You heard me talk on and on about how I did this with Freedom of Information Act requests, et cetera. If you're interested in this sort of approach, do something on your own. I'm not saying make a request. Why don't you go online to the NTSB or FAA site and see what you have to do it. And then if you think of an event that is of interest to you, take some action. By the way, it's probably going to cost you absolutely nothing unless there's a humongous amount of documentation. So you've got nothing to lose.
Okay. And in closing, I would like to remind everybody that if you're going to go flying, do a very thorough planning session. You know, we've done a number of accidents so far in this program that have pilots that have taken off from an airport and lost an engine. Some of them right over the airport, immediately after the liftoff, and with outcomes that weren't very good. Some tried to return to the field doing the impossible turn, which is not advisable. And it was clear that they didn't plan ahead that if I do lose an engine on takeoff, where am I going to put this airplane? Looking at the terrain around the airport and so on and so on. So please do a good job of pre-planning and planning for the unexpected. When you hit the weather, remember, it's not just weather where you're leaving from and where you're going to land, it's the weather in between. And if you're going any distance, it can change a lot between the time you take off and the time you get there. We have a lot of tools available to us today to take care of the weather problems so that you can identify them as a pilot, identify those problems and avoid them. But we see all too often that pilots don't do that as good as they are, as well as they should. And when you get to the airport, revisit your planning session. When you go out to your airplane, do a thorough walk around, touch your airplane, wiggle the flight controls. You know, don't forget tire pressures. We've had several problems this year with tires on airplanes being low. And after you get in the airplane, make sure you do the adequate pre-flight before you take off. After you take off, put that head of yours on a swivel. Mid-airs around the airport are just growing and growing this year for whatever reason. I'm beginning to think it's because we have more and more people, students flying, but it's not fair to the students to say it's their fault, because we just had one that did involve a student, but it wasn't his fault. It was a much more experienced pilot that hit his airplane. The student had no idea or no way to see the airplane coming, quartering him from the rear. So it is a responsibility of a pilot to keep your head screwed on right. It's a risky business flying. So please, please pay attention. follow the procedures, keep your eyes open, and fly safely.
To listen or watch more episodes of this show, go to FlightSafetyDetectives.com, the Flight Safety Detectives YouTube channel, or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. To contact John and Greg about the show, send them an email at FlightSafetyDetectives@gmail.com. And remember, for aviation insurance needs, contact Avemco Insurance at Avemco.com or give them a call at 888-879-0389. Mention Flight Safety Detectives and receive a 5% discount. Thanks for listening to the Flight Safety Detectives, and remember to always fly safe.